It also has an entourage of pretty boys with magical dragon powers, which I think is one of its most crucial selling points.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Welcome back to another episode of Keep It Fictional with the Port Moody Public Library. I am Virginia and here with my book friends, Corrine, Emma, and Sadie. Now, today we're going to be talking about, I like to think of it as the book equivalent of a turducken. Yeah, I know. I see your face, Corrine. I have the same face when I heard about it. I don't know about my book friends, but I'm not a good cook. I'm very much a recipe person. If you give me a recipe, I'm able to follow it. I can probably produce something edible. At least you won't die from it. That's my standard. I'm not like one of those people who can just be like, oh, I'm just going to take a bunch of these and a bunch of that and then just throw it in a pot and then make something amazing and delicious. That is not me. So today we're going to look at authors who may successfully or maybe not, I guess we'll find out, take something from column A and take something from column B and put it all together and mash it all up and produce a wonderful, wonderful book. We're going to be talking about genre mashup. We're going to be talking about genre hybrids. We're going to be talking about books that defy definition of genres. Hopefully for authors who know their craft so well, who know the tropes, who know what it takes to make a genre or whatever, and then try to see if they can push the boundary a little bit and combine them to make something new, to make something different. So that is kind of what we are going to be talking about today. And it's kind of inspired by a recent rising popularity of a particular genre mashup. And I figure that because this is sort of like a library podcast, we're supposed to be on top of books, on top of trends. We should really do an episode on this. But I don't want to torture myself and make myself read one of them. So my compromise was, well, we'll do like expand it into a genre mashup that you can pick and choose your own adventure. But that will still give Sadie a chance to talk about this very popular genre mashup. So Sadie, you can talk about it.
All right. Well, I will get to what the mashup is in just a moment and my feelings on the word itself. But I will say that I actually tend to read quite a lot of genre mashups, as I do like to have magic and fantasy just kind of thrown into other genres. So I actively will search out like mystery fantasy or historical fantasy. I can kind of sort of maybe just a little bit even stomach like a horror novel if it has just a little bit of magic in it. But I would say that one of my favorite mashups is one that it has been around for a while, even though the trend of it is more recent. The actual genre mashup has been around for a very, very long time. And that is fantasy romance, or as it is more commonly known these days, romanticy. Romanticy. Now, you may love the mashup title, or like me, you may just rather call them paranormal or fantasy romances like they have always been called, and you don't fully understand why there needed to be a new word created for this. However, despite my dislike of the word romanticy, I do really, really love this genre. And so I am very excited to talk about the book that I have today, which I'm actually quite surprised that I have not talked about on the podcast before. And that is A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas. Now, I first read this book in 2017. I first discovered Maas's first series, Throne of Glass, and I loved it so much that I knew that I had to read everything that this author had written. I was immediately hooked on the story and the characters and the world that she created. Despite not always, I think I've mentioned on the podcast, I'm not a huge fan of stories about the Fae. They're just not where I usually am drawn to. Weirdly enough, I have read a lot of them, but they're not kind of my favorite kind of fantasy. But I have now read all of the books in this series, all of the books in Sarah J. Maas's other teen series, and I've started her adult series as well. I've gone a little bit away from her stuff just because it has become a little bit closer to erotica than I would like to be reading sometimes. But the Throne of Glass series is not that bad. And the start of this one is also relatively tame. That is kind of how I found my way to this book. And to prepare for this episode, I actually even reread the book, which is a big first for me, or not a first, but it doesn't happen very often. But I decided that I would listen to the audiobook this time while I was driving and just kind of get back into the world. And I think that it has inspired me to reread the entire series that way. So I think I'm going to slowly listen to the entire series again. So The Court of Thorns and Roses tells the story of Feyre. Now, she has heard the tales of the fairies her whole life. The horror stories of how these ruthless, cruel, powerful creatures had once ruled the entire world, taking humans as slaves. Even now, 500 years after the war that finally earned humans their freedom, the stories of the fairies are still told. They're told to children as cautionary tales. They're told in taverns, men and women boasting about how they faced a fairy and, through their own prowess and strength, somehow managed to survive. They're told by the traveling merchants and peddlers who use people's superstitions to sell iron charms and magical sigils that they claim will stop a fairy from entering your house. Feyre has heard them all. While she knows not all of the stories are probably true, she knows enough to know that the cruelty of the fairies and what they did to her kind is not a lie. She also knows that the only reason they aren't still enslaving and murdering humans is because of the treaty that was signed in the aftermath of the war, and the magical, invisible wall that now separates the human world from Prithian, the fairy world. She knows not to approach the wall, not to go anywhere near it, unless she wants to die a horrifying death. But it's winter, and Feyre hasn't been able to hunt anything substantial enough to feed her family for weeks. And she knows that if she doesn't come home with something, anything, then her father and her two sisters, as well as herself, won't survive much longer. So she wanders further and further away from home, further and further north, until she realizes that she's closer to the wall than she has ever been before. She's freezing. Her fingers are numb around her bow and arrow, and she's just about to give up when she spots a small doe eating bark from a tree. This animal would feed her family for a week, maybe two, and she could sell the hide and maybe finally replace her hole-filled boots, although she knows that her sisters will probably claim the money long before she gets a chance to spend it on herself. She's silently drawing her bow when she realizes she's not the only one who has noticed the deer. In the bushes, she sees two shining golden eyes. A wolf, bigger than any she has ever seen, is creeping up on the deer. She knows that it must be from Prithian. No mortal wolf would be that big and that silent as it moved through the forest. Feyre knows that if he spots her, she would be dead before she could think to draw her bow, especially if he was in fact a fairy. But he looks like a wolf, not a fairy. And the amount of money that she'd be able to get for selling his pelt alone would feed her family for a month. So just as the wolf leaps and tackles the deer, Feyre pulls a long arrow from her quiver made of mountain ash, with an iron tip, just in case it's maybe a fairy. And she fires. She arrives home with a thick wolf pelt wrapped around the deer, blood streaking her arms and face. Neither of her sisters nor her father offer to help her with her heavy load, just asking how long it will take for her to clean the doe. She knows they're all starving, and at least one of her sisters doesn't mean to be cruel. However, she can't help but think that maybe if she wasn't the only one going out and looking for food, they wouldn't be in such dire straits to begin with. Ever since they'd lost their fortune 8 years earlier and the creditors came for their father, destroying his leg and knee in their attack, it has been up to Feyre to provide for her whole family. The youngest of three, it didn't make a lot of sense. However, neither Nesta nor Lane had been forced to make a deathbed promise to their mother that no matter what happened, they would look after her family. So Feyre swallows whatever sharp comment she's about to make and goes to clean and cook the deer. Now, she doesn't think much more about the wolf and where it may have come from until a few nights later. Her and her sisters have returned from the market, Feyre somehow being able to sell both the deer and the wolf pelt for far more than they are worth. Family is just about to sit down for dinner in their falling apart two-room cottage when the door is blown off its hinges and the biggest, most terrifying creature that Farah has ever seen steps into the room. The creature is huge, and it looks slightly feline, but also wolfish, with curled elk-like horns protruding from its head. Farah is even more surprised when the creature speaks. "Murderers," it yells at her family. "Murderers." It is in this moment that Farah knows that what she is looking at is a fairy. And not just a fairy, one of the High Fae. The Fae goes on to claim that the wolf was in fact a fairy, a friend of his, and whoever killed them was in direct violation of the treaty. The penalty? A life for a life. Farah has never heard this side of the treaty, but she must admit to herself that she'd never really paid much attention to it before. And she can't deny that she killed the wolf. And so she steps up to receive her punishment. She's shocked when the creature, instead of killing her, offers her a small mercy. She can come and live in Prithian and serve it by giving her life forever. She will never be able to return home. She realizes that she doesn't really have any choice. And after leaving very quick instructions with her father on how to save the deer meat for as long as he can, she leaves her home without looking back. Farah arrives in Prithian and is shocked when it is nothing like what she expected. All that she knows of the fairy world is that any mortal who happens to go there will not survive long against the terrible creatures and the cruel and powerful high lords of the seven fairy courts. What she's not expecting is a beautiful land of eternal spring, trees and flowers in bloom, sprawling grounds and a beautiful manor house where she's treated more like a guest than a prisoner. And the last thing that she ever expected was that the horrifying creature who took her from her home has now transformed into a mortal-looking man. Golden hair, tanned skin, strong body, and a strange mask covering the top half of his face. He introduces himself as Tamlin and tells Farah that while she is free to live anywhere in Prithian, according to the treaty, she will most likely not survive very long if she chooses to leave Tamlin's lands. Farah, of course, does not trust the man, but also knows that she doesn't really have any other choice, and that his warnings against the dangers of the fairy world are at least probably true. So she makes up her mind to stay in the manor house, build up her strength, steal weapons, and pack a bag so that one day she can be prepared to flee back to her family. The more that Farah spends in Tamlin's house, the more she realizes that things may not be as simple as that. There's more going on in Prithian than she realizes, including a horrible blight. A magic that has impacted not just the High Lords, but everyone in the fairy world. It is what caused Tamlin and his entire household to be trapped wearing these strange masks, and what has led to horrible, dangerous, deadly creatures being found on Tamlin's lands. The more time Farah spends in Tamlin's house, she also realizes that she might not want to escape anymore. She's found a friend in Tamlin's emissary, Lucien, a sarcastic but loyal High Fae from the Autumn Court. And Tamlin has assured her that her family is being taken care of, and so she's found joy again in one of her favorite hobbies, painting, something which she hasn't been able to think about in years when she was so focused on keeping her family alive. And most importantly, she started to learn more about Tamlin, the High Lord of the Spring Court, a caring man who never wanted to inherit the title of High Lord, a fierce warrior who would do anything to protect his court and his people and Farah. Farah and Tamlin's attraction for each other grows and grows, and the more time that Farah spends in the Spring Court, Farah realizes that she is now more than happy to spend the rest of her days in Prithian with Tamlin. However, the magical blight is rising again, and Farah is learning that even she may not be able to escape its hold, and she'll soon learn what exactly this evil magic is willing to do to get what it wants. So you may have noticed from the description, this book is actually based on Beauty and the Beast. I think that in knowing that, the story can seem a little bit predictable. However, Maz has done a good job of adding kind of additional intrigue and additional antagonists and additional storyline, which allows the story to definitely stand on its own. And it has opened it up for sequels, which go away quite a bit from its original source material. As I mentioned, I love this book. I love this series. Vera is a strong-willed protagonist who I think would very easily fall into the warrior women category, if not in this first book, definitely in the later books. It very easily fits into the romantasy mashup genre. I would warn you that, as I mentioned at the beginning, some of the books get quite graphic as they go on. And so if you're not okay with reading explicit sex scenes, then maybe avoid this series, or at least any of the books after the first one. First one is a bit tamer than the second and the third, and the fourth is just porn. So the book does have quite a strong fae and fairy themes to it, which I mentioned, they're not usually my favorite. However, I think that Sarah J. Maas does a good job of focusing kind of on the specific characters and not just on the more stereotypical, crafty, cruel fae characteristics that are often included in these books. And so I think that even if you're not a huge fan of fairy books and fae books, then you can still find interest in this book and its characters. I would say that if you're a fan of Maas's other series, or if you like Rebecca Ross, Jennifer Armentrout, Holly Black, or if you're just like me and enjoy anything with a heavy dose of magic and romance, then I would check out A Court of Thorns and Roses, a romantasy mashup book.
Well, thank you, Sadie, for saying that word. You know what? I realized that I actually don't like, I hated the word so much when I first heard about it. But then now I realize it's actually very helpful for me because I know exactly what to avoid. Because I hate it when books lie to me, right? You're a romance. Just say you're a romance. Like, don't pretend that you're a fantasy. And then like, you end up reading like, wait, what? Like, this is not like, yeah. So I actually don't mind it anymore because it's not a lie anymore. So I'm okay with that. Just like how when Goodreads like decide to differentiate the two in their like choices award, right? And then just have a romanticy section and it has a fantasy, because then like, you know, the fantasy, like the actual fantasy have a chance and the romanticy could have their own category because they are so important apparently. Anyway, so yeah.
Nothing wrong with romanticy. I didn't read a romanticy book, but I'm here to champion. There's nothing wrong. I do agree with Virginia on one point, which is shocking in this conversation, and that it actually is very helpful sometimes when there is that particular label and that you can kind of help differentiate it as to like the purpose of the book. Like if you're looking for a romance with fantasy elements, like sometimes that's really hard to kind of pick for and search. And sometimes these labels are like super useful if you're into that thing, which I am, then this kind of portmanteau is very useful.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's useful. It's useful for you. It's useful for me. Like it's perfect.
Me and Emma were talking yesterday and I'm super excited about when rom mystery becomes a trending topic.
Which is super interesting because honestly, like a lot of mystery books do have an element of romance in them. Like even if you go back to like golden age classics like Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie, usually interwoven within the plot of a traditional mystery is a romance, because it's all about like making sure everything is right and correct in the world. And that means the people hook up with each other and like do makeouts. So it is interesting, like within a lot of mystery genre it's like built into it is romance.
Okay, well, I guess we can start these new words, and then we can start putting in our catalog, and then maybe other libraries will follow along, and then we'll make it very clear to people what exactly there is. Then it will be easier for us to find books, right? Like last time when we talked about like how to find, like, is there enough tea in this book? Is there enough warrior woman? Like how much fighting is in it, right? Like, so it's helpful. Anyway, all right, Emma, what kind of genre mashup have you got for us today?
Oh, my book, like name a genre, my book has it. This is one of my favorite series, so I'm actually really excited about this topic because it gives me an excuse to talk about one of my all-time favorite manga series. Dare I say, you could technically call it a romanticy. I'm on the same page as Virginia and Sadie. I don't like the word. I find it very silly that this whole new category has been come up with. People have come up with this whole new category to describe a phenomenon that has existed like for so long. Like Twilight was a romanticy, but no one was using the word romanticy when Twilight was popular. And like Corinne just said, you can find romance in all these different types of genres. It already exists in mystery. It already exists in thriller. So I find it quite silly that people are making a huge deal out of romanticy being this new thing when like romance is everywhere. But I digress. So for this week, I initially chose a book that had been on my TBR for a long time, but I realized I'd probably get quite a bit of grief from my book friends for claiming that something that's a mashup of horror and sci-fi and magical realism was a genre mashup. So to avoid that grief, I decided to veer to what I believe is a true genre mashup. And like I said, one of my absolute personal favorite series that I've already tried to convince all of my present book friends today to read. So this is no surprise to anybody here. And this series has everything. It's got romance, it's got politics and war, it has wacky side adventures that feature pirates, it has an entourage of beautiful boys with the powers of a magical dragon, and in my opinion, it has a little bit of something for everybody. So today I'm sharing one of my all-time favorite manga series with you all. It's called Yona of the Dawn by the author Mizuho Kusanagi, who does the story and the illustrations in it. So on the surface, Yona of the Dawn is a shoujo manga series, meaning that it's a series that's intended for young girls. But it's so much more than just a regular shoujo. It's a historical romance that takes place in a fictional kingdom called Koka, which is a country with a diverse landscape and even more diverse populations of people. The kingdom is separated into five tribes. So we've got the Earth Tribe, the Water Tribe, the Fire Tribe, the Wind Tribe, and then the Sky Tribe, which houses the royal family. Each tribe has its own unique cultural traditions, styles of dress, and its own unique sets of struggles faced by the people. Koka is a country that as a whole is quite segregated and disconnected. The tribes all kind of have their own unique situations going on. At the beginning of the story, we meet Yona, and she is a spoiled princess and the only child of King Eel, the king of Koka. Yona lives a life of lavish ease and luxury. She spends all of her time just frolicking around the palace, wearing elaborate dresses and trying on the newest and most expensive perfumes and makeup. She has very little care for politics and for what's happening around her kingdom, and she doesn't really feel like she has to care. Her father, King Eel, is a pacifist and an isolationist. He chooses to stay out of international conflicts and chooses a neutral stance on any political or economic issues that arise both within and outside of the kingdom. This helps the king maintain a facade of peace, but the reality is that Koka is anything but prosperous. Many of the regions throughout the five tribes are experiencing famine and disease and economic collapse. And the nations that are surrounding Koka are constantly threatening war and invasion. The Water Tribe in particular is dealing with a drug epidemic, kind of similar to an opioid epidemic, and one of Koka's international borders is facing a crisis that involves human trafficking. So the story is marketed to audiences as a fantasy romance, or a romanticy, dare I say, but under the surface, it's a political story about war and about failing governments. Yona, as a spoiled princess, is blind to all of the struggles that the people of Koka are facing. She's never left the palace before, and her biggest concern is getting ready for her upcoming 16th birthday party and the highly anticipated visit of her beloved cousin, Suwon. Suwon and Yona grew up together, adventuring around the palace and getting into all types of mischief with Suwon's best friend and an accomplished soldier from the Wind Tribe named Hawk. For Yona, Suwon is everything that a king should be. He's handsome, he's gracious, he's charismatic, and an excellent fighter. And he's everything that she could dream of for a future husband and a future king of Koka. But despite her love and her affection for him, her father refuses to allow them to be together. And pretty soon, Yona learns why. After her birthday party, Suwon stages a bloody coup and murders her father, the king, and also his uncle. When she witnesses the assassination, Yona is forced to flee with only Hawk, Suwon's former best friend and Yona's closest bodyguard and confidant at her side. Both Yona and Hawk feel betrayed, and in her bewildered state, Hawk takes Yona to his home in the Wind Tribe to find refuge and to reconvene. The elders of the Wind Tribe direct Yona and Hawk to a priest that's hiding out in the forest, somebody who can hopefully give them answers as to what Yona's purpose is now that she's lost her livelihood, now that she's away from the palace, and how she could get her rightful kingdom back. They find the priest after barely escaping an attack from Fire Tribe soldiers, who assume that both Yona and Hawk have perished in the battle. The priest tells Yona of a prophecy. If she is to go on living, then Hawk cannot be the only one caring for her. So she's tasked to find four legendary dragon warriors, four humans who each possess their own unique magical powers that have been passed down for generations. And together, The dragons can help not only protect Yona from the dangers following her, but they can also help her protect the entire kingdom of Koka. Yona is skeptical of this priest. She doesn't believe that four random warriors who've never met her would agree to follow a random princess, especially solely for the selfish purpose of protecting her. But she and Hawk embark on their journey anyway. And with the priest's trusted caretaker and apothecary, a young boy named Yoon, at their side, they feel more confident that they can not only find the dragons, but they can also find a way to save Koka. On their travels searching for the dragons, Yona is able to see her kingdom, a kingdom that she's supposed to one day rule, with her own eyes for the first time, since before this, she had never left the palace. What she finds is not the peaceful and prosperous kingdom that she believed Koka to be during her father's reign. She encounters poverty and hardship in every one of the five tribes. Citizens go days without food to eat or clean clothes to wear. And she's grief-stricken, not only for the loss of her father, but also for the loss of the home that she thought she knew. This realization for Yona that King Il's Koka isn't all that she believed it to be lights a fire in her. Not only does she want to overthrow Suwon and take her kingdom back, but she wants to save it first. From her adventures and the friends that she meets along the way, she gains new knowledge and strength that she can use to make Koka a better kingdom and a safer kingdom. And once she unites all four of the dragon warriors, she and her friends have the physical strength and the prowess to do just that. So, like I said earlier, Yona of the Dawn is technically a fantasy romance series, but it is so much more than just that. It's a war story with intense battle sequences. There's a lot of strategy involved in the war scenes. It's also an adventure story with a lot of wacky side quests that, like I said before, sometimes have pirates in them, which is really fun. It's a dark political drama with bloody assassinations and commentary on topics like drugs and human trafficking. And it's also a romance about a young woman at the center who becomes stronger and more independent as the story goes on, but also who never loses her empathy and her love for her friends along the way. It also has an entourage of pretty boys with magical dragon powers, which I think is one of its most crucial selling points. So if you like pretty boys, this is the story for you. I love this series not only for its representation of independent and feminist characters, and not just Yona. Like, pretty much every woman you meet is a warrior woman with her own beliefs, her own like ways of fighting for herself, whether that's with weapons or with her words. But I also love it because it's unlike so many other shoujo manga series. It has such a strong focus on human relationships and connection, like other shoujos do. And there's obviously a romance brewing between the two core characters for the entirety of the series. But in addition to that, it also incorporates a lot of the action and adventure and suspense that so many manga genres have that I think shoujo kind of lacks as a whole. So if you like shonen, if you like a lot of kind of action-y fighting series, then you might also be able to get into this one. The author also builds a really incredible world with its own rich cultural history, its own very real political and economic strife, and its own unique sort of magic system. So that's very fun as well. And there's an enormous cast of hilarious and very memorable characters who have great chemistry with one another. Once Yona, Hawk, and Yoon are able to locate and convince all four of the dragon warriors to join them, they've kind of built their own little found family. And it's those scenes with these characters, with this core group of seven people, that I really, really love in this series. The character development and the chemistry is really well written. Each of those seven characters in that main group undergo their own emotional arcs that deepen their characters and deepen their bonds with one another. And Yona's also, like I said earlier, able to build a lot of really strong female friendships with the women that she meets on their adventures, which I feel is especially important given that most of the other main characters in the story and in her group are men. But it definitely does not lack in strong female representation. So this story has a lot of really good representation in the characters. It's got a lot of fun action scenes with fantasy elements that make it for an entertaining adventure, despite the darker themes that are developing below the surface. So I would really recommend Yona of the Dawn to anybody looking for an exciting adventure series, anyone who likes romance or historical fantasy or political drama, or, like I said before, pretty boys with magical dragon powers. I should mention, though, that this series is very long. It has 40 volumes to date, and the 41st comes out in May. I'll talk about that one in next week's episode. So if you're willing to make the commitment to it, I would highly, highly, highly recommend that you check out one of my personal favorite manga, Yona of the Dawn.
I think I know what needs to go on Emma's bingo board now. It's Yona. Emma, we have a bingo board here. Words that we always say on the show. And I think Yona is going to be yours. And I'm just going to focus on the, you said political drama. I'm going to focus on like the darkness because I have that at home right now. I did borrow from the other library, the only library that has it. So I have it. Yeah. So, but I'm just going to ignore everything else that you said and focus on that political drama and the strong warrior.
You mean I didn't sell you with Pretty Dragon Boys? You don't love Pretty Dragon Boys?
No, I'm good. So I didn't actually tell my book friends ahead of time what our question is going to be, but it's going to be an easy one. Don't worry. Since we're talking about like, you know, book and book trends and, you know, things like that, I would love to know general feelings about book trends. Like, are you curious about them? When a book trend comes up, you're like, oh, I wonder why that is. You want to read some of them and find out. Are you the kind of person you're like, well, it depends. If it's a book trend that I like, then sure, I will be happy for it to exist. Or are you like just tired? You could get tired of it very easily. Like, what are your feelings about just book trends in general?
I think usually the question that I have is like, why this one? I think like book talk is like so interesting. I'm always just fascinated as to like, why this book? Why this author? Like, there's so many better ones out there. Why is it this one that happened to like get all the attention and all the popularity and like all the readership? So I think that that is like really fascinating, is that I can never quite pinpoint what and why a particular one is very, very popular, because there are some very trendy authors that I had read before and I was like, oh yeah, that's fine. Like, that's all right. There's nothing wrong with that. It's very solid. And then it just kind of took off and I kind of wanted to like take people by the shoulders and be like, but there's so much better out there. It's like when E.L. James and 50 Shades of Grey came out, I was like, no, we can do better than this. There's so much better. But usually I'm like curious, and if it's within my wheelhouse, I might pick it up.
I feel that, Corinne, about like wanting something that's better than the things that are just popular. Like, I don't understand the Colleen Hoover trend. Like, I think she just writes pop lit. I've never read any of them. I never will. But I just like, I don't understand why it is that people, like so many teens would come into the library and be like, I want Colleen Hoover. I want Colleen Hoover. And I'm like, why? But anyway, as far as trends go, like if it's something that I know I'll like some romanticy I might enjoy and I might seek out depending on what the book is, but I'm not going to seek it out just because it's trendy, just because it's new. Like, I do seek out things like Before the Coffee Gets Cold, the book about the library, like those cute little Japanese books. I do really like that kind of stuff. So I will read those even when they become really trendy. But I like to think that life is too short to read bad stuff. So if it doesn't sound like I'll enjoy it, then I'm just not going to bother, you know?
There you go. I do have to do a shout out to, I think I can say this on the podcast, a Bigalus Dickalus, who recommended and kind of shot off This Is How You Win the Time War, which went wonderfully viral and deserved all the praise and was wonderful and amazing.
I love that book. That book's great.
I think I just get mad with trends when they're things that have been around forever and people don't pay any attention to them until they're put into the spotlight for, like you said, Corinne, some reason. And who knows what the reason is? Like, who knows why romanticy right now is what everyone is trying to push? Because like I said, like, it's been around for so long. Oh, Corinne knows. Okay, I'm excited.
It's absolutely fan fiction tropes, which I find absolutely fascinating. And I'm 100% behind it. Well done, everyone.
Fair enough. Yes, I think I just get more upset with trends than anything. And I'm like, it's been here all along. It's been here all along. Why do you not pay attention to it?
Oh, thank you, everyone. For me, it's more like things that are popular, I just like to stay away from it. It doesn't matter what it is. The more somebody says, unless it's Emma, obviously, you have to read it. Then I'm like, no, thank you. So yeah, like, I mean, like, took me forever. Like, after everything, like, nobody cares about Game of Thrones anymore. That's when I started to go read it, because I'm like, I'm not interested in this. So yeah, I am just one of those people that, you know, the more popular something is, the more I'm just want to stay away from it.
You're not alone, Virginia. I relate to that so hard.
Yeah, I find sometimes that even when it's like offers or something I really, really like, and then suddenly like the whole world likes it, I'm like, you're only reading it because it's popular rather than like, yeah, anyway. So then I'm just like, eh. Anyway, so I'm going to go next. And I think to no surprise, just like Sadie said, I do like mashup, do like books that defy genre definitions. It's fun when people go outside the box and try to put things together and make it work, I think, obviously. So as I was choosing a book for today, I realized I do gravitate weirdly towards mashups that has genres that I don't usually read. Noir came to come up a lot. I have actually talked a few on the podcast. And for some reason, if you give me a, I don't even read that, but if you give me a noir, like you tell me it's a noir plus science fiction, like I'm there. So today's the same thing. I also have like a book that has a genre like on its own that I don't really read. I don't know what it is. It just doesn't appeal to me. But somehow when it combines with things, it becomes a little bit more appealing. So this is a book that has been, Emma is going to think it's a cop out because like I did pick one of those where it's like a steampunk plus like fantasy and science fiction, horror, Lovecraftian level kind of stuff, apocalyptic dystopian with a heavy dose of like literary. It's just everything together. But I think a steampunk world, which I don't really care for, but this book actually works really well. And full disclosure, I was telling my book friends, it's the first time I have not actually finished a book for the podcast. I just didn't have really capacity to do this past couple of weeks. I feel like it's been like ages since I've actually finished a book, which is quite scary. But I know that I like it enough that I can put my name with it. And I also feel like I was going to rush through it. Then I feel like, well, no, I want to enjoy this because I do actually like it that much that I want to enjoy it and don't want to rush it. And of course, it's also very silly of me to pick a 700-page book, knowing that I don't have any capacity. I don't understand why I did that. So it's all like completely my own fault. But anyway, this book also, and I guess that's this year, this book also features a bug, many bugs actually, but start with a bug, a caterpillar or a caterpillar-like thing. I don't know, because Isaac has never seen anything like this before. So he's not really sure what this creature is, but looks kind of like a caterpillar. And this caterpillar is one of the latest creatures that he has procured for his current project. Isaac is a university professor who has quit his job and is now a rogue scientist. He lives in a warehouse. That's where he has his sleeping quarters and his lab/office all together, which he shared with two other scientists. And now that he has left his job, he has a chance to pursue and try out things and test out stuff that may be considered a little bit too risky or experimental for the university. One day, Isaac has a visitor, a Garuda. And that's one of the best things I think about this book is the world and all the different beings and creatures and species that populate it. And a Garuda is kind of like a tall, thin, bird-like thing, a bird-like being. But this Garuda has lost his ability to fly. His wings has been ripped off for a crime that he thinks he has committed. And so that's kind of his punishment. And he has come to Isaac to help him so that he can regain his power to fly. For Isaac, this is an exciting challenge. He loves challenges and, you know, also that the Garuda can pay him. So that's great. And he figures that he needs to attack this problem from all angles. And in this world, science, of course, you know, you got the type of science that we think of it as science. But in this world, also like a lot of it also feels kind of like magic. And so one of the first steps he thinks he needs to do is to find lots and lots of examples of flying creatures, things that could fly, that he's going to gather legally and maybe some not so legally, because he wants to study flight and he wants to uncover the secrets to figure out what is the best for the Garuda. But he's not just interested in just the ones who already can fly, but he also wants to see the process of how they mature, how they develop. So he has a lot of other creatures that are going to become flying things. Hence this caterpillar thing that may or may not grow wings at some point. But the thing is, this caterpillar looks like it's dying. It has refused to eat since it got there. No matter what Isaac tries to feed it, it has refused everything. And, you know, it's just one caterpillar. I mean, his whole warehouse is full of crates and crates of all these winged creatures that he should really spend time studying. But he just keeps coming back to this caterpillar. There's something about it. Maybe he feels bad for it. He doesn't know. But just what is this caterpillar? He just can't help but just stare at it all the time and trying to figure out well, this caterpillar is going to be a creature that is going to bring Isaac a world of trouble when Isaac finds out what food it actually eats. This book is an older book. It is Perdido Street Station by China Mirabel. And I think it's one of the ones who won like a Nebula or Hugo or some of the awards. And like I said earlier, the world that Mirabel has built is fantastic. It is just the best kind of strange. It's one of those books where you definitely feel like the city is a character on its own. One of the reviewers described it as, it's like, this is almost like a travel guide to the city. You feel like you're just getting to know the city as the story progresses. It's not a nice city. It's a grimy, smoky, smelly kind of city. And I love the description that Mirabel did for it. He said that it's like the rotting buildings, they lean against each other. They're exhausted. The river, they smears slime on its brick banks, the city walls risen from the depths to hold the water at bay. And he talks about how light just seemed to give up the struggle halfway through those thick, soiled windows, leaving the interior in shadow. So it's a dark, dark kind of place. And in the middle of this giant city is an imposing title, Perdido Train Station, a station that has five different lines that go through the city from other places. And this is sort of the center of it. I read about 500 pages, so I still have 200 pages to go. The station is there, definitely. I got to know the station, but like I haven't gone really inside yet. So I'm very curious to know like what's inside the station, because they talk about how central it is to the city. And the world also gets more and more intriguing as Mirabel introduces to more and more the people that live in the city, or the creatures that live in the city. Isaac's secret lover is Lynn, and we follow her story a little bit in the beginning. And Lynn, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but Lynn is a Capri, which is a Egyptian mythological being, I believe, that has a scarab for a head and a human body. And they, of course, have to keep this kind of a love affair secret because, you know, human and Capri, they shouldn't be together kind of thing. And Lynn is an artist, and she has also abandoned her community because they use art in a way that she doesn't really agree with. So she wanted to leave, and she wanted to like try to find her own way. And the way that they do art is that they use like certain body materials to create art. And so just the process of how they do it is just fascinating. And then like there's all sorts of other creatures. There's like demons that the city council deals with. There are sentient vacuum cleaners. There are spiders that play with and can change reality when they play with the web and the strings and all that kind of stuff. Even just the ones that he mentioned in passing, like he talks about like cockroach head trees. It just sounds so amazing. Like it just, this whole world is just full of these strangest, most surreal like beings. And it is just so wonderful. But I'm also not just in the world, because, you know, like if it is just the world and there's no story, that doesn't work either. But I'm very pleasantly surprised that the plot also moves along very well. I feel like it's almost like I'm watching a movie. I can totally see like people adapting this as to a TV series or anything like that, because it just, the action is so clear. It moves along. It's got a great plot and a very, maybe some parts like kind of predictable, but it moves very, very well. And I was surprised because I read some of like Mirabel's newer work and I have like no idea what he was talking about. Like, you know, so this was like surprising that his older work, maybe a little bit more plot driven, which of course makes his upcoming book super promising. Because speaking of mashup, two people that I never would have thought that they're going to cross path is going to be crossing paths in July, because Mirabel is collaborating on a book with none other than Keanu Reeves. I was going to mention this on the most anticipated episode next week, but here it is. Keanu Reeves, China Mirabel. I don't know how the two got together, but the new book coming out is called The Book of Elsewhere. It is inspired by a graphic novel series, actually, that is created by Keanu Reeves called Berserker, which I haven't read yet, but I'll be curious. So I am just dying to find out how those two can come together. Who is going to win? Is it the weirdness of
China Mirror, or is it going to be Keanu Reeves?
Like I said, it's a long book, but I fully, fully enjoy it. And I now that the deadline to read this has passed, I know that I don't have to rush it along. So I'm going to enjoy the last like 200 pages or so. If you are curious about what China Mirabel, like how he writes, because you're excited about this upcoming collaboration, this upcoming mashup, I highly recommend you check out some of his books. I think this one is great, like Potato Street Station, but it is long. And then the other one that I think often people sort of gravitate towards is The City and the City. So that's another really creative one. So yeah, so this is Potato Street Station by China Mirabel. All right. Last but not least, we have another mashup. We have Corinne. What kind of mashup are we looking at today?
I'm really bummed that I didn't do a romanticy now, but it was mostly because, again, Wednesday night, mashup book. And then what was in the library at the time. And so I ended up, again, repping popularism, a Reese's Book Club pick from August 2022. I have read grammar's hard some days, some of the other books from this selection. And I remember that when she started this book club, she had a job posting for like a personal book pick librarian. I know. And I was like, what a dream job. Essentially, it was to like read through a bunch of books and then recommend books to Reese Witherspoon so that she could pick them for this book club. And I have never wanted a job so badly. Did I apply for it? No. But still, what a dream. And kind of having read a lot of them, actually, I've read quite a few of the picks from this, tends to really skew hard on like women-driven narratives, very heavy on thrillers. And so this particular book is a very interesting mashup of a thriller and what I would kind of term as like a domestic thriller. So that's usually kind of like centered on the family unit rather than something that's kind of like more international spy type stuff. It really is about the relationships between people in a family. But this one has a little bit of a twist. Our main character is Jen, and it is late October, and despite the fact that her one child, Todd, is fully grown, she has decided to carve a pumpkin by herself and put it in the window. Todd, her son, is 18 years old, a bit of a science nerd, but generally a good kid. Jen is a divorce lawyer. She's very busy, and she hasn't had really a lot of time to spend with him. This night, he is out with his new girlfriend, Cleo, that she has not met, and he's about to graduate, and she's just a little worried about him. It's getting late. He's out, and so there she is, waiting for him with her pumpkin. His curfew is technically 1 o'clock, but because daylight savings is ending tonight, there's a little bit of a loophole, and he gets an extra hour out. As she looks over her typical street in a small town in England, she sees her son slowly walking towards the house. Then he stops. He notices someone else standing in the street. From her vantage point from the window, Jen can tell that this is an older man. Todd walks towards this stranger with intent. As he does this, Jen gets a bad feeling. She runs down the stairs, grabs her coat, flings open the door just in time to see the glint of the knife in Todd's hands. Helpless, she watches as Todd, her baby, her son, stabs the man in cold blood. Jen rushes over to the stranger. As he bleeds out in her arms, Todd seems unrepentant, committed to what he has done. Jen looks at the face of this dying stranger and does not recognize him at all. When she asks her son, he simply shuts his mouth and cannot answer. Everything after that moves very quickly. They call the ambulance for the stabbed stranger. The police arrive. Todd is taken to the station, booked. And despite Jen and her husband, Kelly, trying to argue with the police to just talk to their son, to try and understand what happened, to try and get him some help, they are told that there is nothing to be done. They should go home, sleep, and they'll sort it out the next morning. Jen and her husband, Kelly, don't know what to do. this situation is almost unbelievable. Their son, their sweet, young, wonderful son, has murdered someone. Jen, hands tied, decides to get some sleep, and maybe when she wakes up in the morning, everything will become clear and they can figure out what steps they need to take next to help her son. She goes to sleep. She wakes up. But she wakes up yesterday. She wakes up the day before the murder. The day before her entire world came crashing down around her. And there's Todd. He's not in jail. He hasn't stabbed anyone. He's behaving normally. Nothing seems out of place. Her husband, Kelly, when she explains what happened, doesn't believe her. He has no memory of a murder, no memory of going to the police station, no memory of losing their son into the justice system that Jen works in. Thus starts Jen's journey back in time. Every night when she goes to sleep, she wakes up and finds herself moving backwards in time, further away from the murder, and unable to prevent what she knows is in the future. As she hurtles back in time, she comes closer to the true motive of the crime. She can sense, or at least she hopes, that the reason why she is undergoing this strange progression in time is that she can discover that the key to this lies somewhere in her past. Somewhere is the heart of what caused this, something that she didn't notice before. She hopes that if she can find the truth of this crime, that she will be able to prevent it in her future. Wrong Place, Wrong Time is the New York Times best-selling book by Gillian McAllister. It's a very interesting mashup of a domestic thriller and kind of a sci-fi time-traveling extravaganza. The author kind of said in her notes that she wanted to do kind of like a Russian nesting doll of a novel, in that at the outside of it, you have this crime that happened. And as by going back in time, you get like closer and closer and closer and closer to like the real truth of what happened and the real mystery in it. At one point, I believe the main character says she's inceptioning this. And yeah, that's exactly what this is, which is not such a bad thing. It's very kind of like Groundhoggy Day, but Lisa Jewell-ish. It has kind of like these interesting sci-fi elements. And I did enjoy that our main character, Jen, tracks down like a physicist, science person, and tries to like justify this and being like, hey, what's going on? I'm going back in time. And what I really enjoyed is that the scientist has like a code word that he discovered when he was a kid, that if he ever met a time traveler, he'd say that to them in the future. And then when they went back, they'd say the same code word to him so that he knew they were a time traveler. And I was like, that's so smart. So I really enjoyed that. Yeah, it really does clip along. Again, like I find with a lot of the Reese's Book Club picks is that they're very, you know, the characterization is pretty good. But what is the best about it is that it goes down real smooth. Like I blasted through this book in an evening. I was like, okay, let's do this. Let's go. Each of the little chapters is as she's kind of like going back in time, sometimes a day, sometimes a couple of days, and then sometimes years. I'm going further and further back in her history. Of course, like anything with a domestic thriller, it's kind of like figuring out, okay, like what's the secret lie in this family? And does it work? Enough. It works enough. If you don't really think about it too hard, then it works perfectly. But the last line of the book was so stupid that it made me quite angry, because the rest of the book is very solid. Like Gillian McAllister is a very good thriller writer, and that you really do enjoy it. You want to know more. The mystery is kind of very intriguing. Last line was just so stupid. And so if anyone listening to this podcast reads this book and then we can talk about it like spoiler wise, I'd love to know your take on it, because I was with her. I was walking, not exactly beside her, but kind of like behind her, being like, yeah, you forge this path, I'll follow after, up until the last line. And that just made me so angry. So yeah, if you do, let's connect, let's talk, let's tear that little bit apart in what is otherwise a very enjoyable read. So if you're looking for kind of like what on the surface should be a very basic thriller, but has these kind of like sci-fi elements put in, I would definitely recommend putting this up. If you've got like an evening free and you just want to be taken on a nice ride and solve a little mystery, then definitely pick up Wrong Place, Wrong Time, but skip the last like paragraph.
All right. Well, thank you, Corinne. It sounds like everybody has a good mashup experience. So that's good. I'm glad. Any other like mashup you want to see?
I like all of them. As you said, like Virginia, when you kind of looked through it, you did like you went through your reading list and you saw that there was a lot of that. Just because it's so intriguing when someone's taking kind of the tropes and beats of something else and then transposing it into another one. It's just so fun. Like if you're a genre reader and you're like, oh, like this is the beat of a mystery, but it's like overlaid with a sci-fi, like a sci-fi mystery. I would read a million more of those, actually. That's what I'm going to put in my vote for, more sci-fi mystery.
I really liked Virginia's point earlier about like sci-fi noir. And that reminded me of one of my favorite anime series. Unfortunately, it's not a book, but it's Cowboy Bebop. Which is like, yeah, love for Cowboy Bebop. Obviously, some people in the room know, but it's like a sci-fi space cowboy bounty hunter thing. But it's all jazz, and it's like this got it's got this like noir coolness to it. I want more of that. I want more like cool noir stuff, but in space.
I mean, I've said it before. Anything with magic, throw magic into any other genre, and I will read it, and I will most likely absolutely love it. So, which I think it has been done as well. It's a common genre to add into other genres. I think that fantasy and that romance, they're easy to kind of put into other genres. So that has been done a lot. But yeah, put magic into anything. I'll read it.
Yeah. And I was going to read it's called The Night Parade. And it's billed as a speculative memoir, which I find really quite interesting. Like, you know, I don't know, read memoir again, right? Like, but no, I think what it is that it takes, yeah, don't do your face yet. It takes Japanese folklore and myths stories and woven into her memoir kind of story. Yeah, no, I think it's going to be pretty good. So yeah, anyway. All right. So thank you, everyone, for doing a mashup. Next week, as we alluded to it, it's going to be our most anticipated episode. Yeah, I'm telling you ahead of time, Corinne. Most anticipated episode. So we're going to talk about books that are coming out in May and August. And Sadie has given us the assignment or that we have to read one of those, right? Like at some point, we have to read a book that we have chosen for as our most anticipated read. So choose wisely, friends, because you might have to read one of them. So anyway, all right. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. We'll see you again next week and have a good reading time. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.